Rothberg of Niagara Capital, and with me is Al Friedberg. Morning, Albert. Today is the
morning.
July. Morning. Al, normally I introduce you by saying it's a pleasure to have with me Al Friedberg, and I don't want you to think that I'm being remiss or personal by not introducing you in that way, but just that today's call, I think, is about a much less pleasurable topic than the past ones have been. We're in the midst of by far the worst drawdown that the fund has suffered since it started in 2001. I think investor responses vary from dismay to anger to disappointment. I've asked investors, and I'll ask again, that if you have questions, Albert has agreed to respond to all questions, and unfortunately we can't take questions over the phone, but what we can do is respond to emailed questions. Because of a renovation in our office, I'd ask you not to email questions to E-Roth as you normally do, but directly to me. And my email address is drothberg, R-O-T-H-B-E-R-G, at niagaracapital.ca. I'll repeat it. It's drothberg at niagaracapital.ca. Okay.
David, yes, let me interrupt for a minute and
sure.
And let me get right to the matter. You know, all of us have been hurt pretty badly in this drawdown, in this very unusual drawdown. And myself, probably more than anyone else, I've the largest share of the fund, maybe over 60 or 65% of the fund. And so I realize that we're all quite hurt. But I do want to make a few points. What I want to do is I want to make a few points. I want to explain my position, make a few points, and then maybe refer back to some of these as we answer questions. And I'm happy to answer all the details that need to be answered.
Sure.
So if I may, I'll start with some of these.
Please.
It's okay, right?
Yes, please.
Okay. The first point I want to make is that we the world, the global economy has entered a very unusual situation. There's been a fundamental change that has taken place in the last 10 to 15 years, and in particular has accelerated in the last 5 years. It has to do with debt. D-E-B-T, has to do with debt. The world has increased the amount of borrowings, individuals, corporations, but mostly individuals and governments have increased their debt. Their balance sheets have been weakened. And this is probably the first time in history, that we have so many large and small governments under the very heavy weight of debt. Now, debt does something that we still don't understand today well, what it does. And there's been, I know, an academic dispute about what is the ideal level of debt and so on. But we do know now that this huge increases in debt have slowed down enormously the growth of income. And when we say debt, we mean the relation of debt to income. As it gets larger and larger, it creates a problem. And if we actually look back for the last 5 and 10 and 15 years, we see a progressive slowdown in the rate of increases in nominal and real income. So we have entered a new period in history. I think that if we look back historically, maybe the last time something like this happened may have been in Solon's Athens, and we got to go back maybe 2,500 years. And the resolution at that time was not very pleasant, and I'm afraid that the resolution this time will not be very pleasant. So that's point number one. And I think that it's very important to keep that in our minds, because it is not well understood. Second point is, central banks have created a bubble, and led by the U.S. government, led by the Federal Reserve, they've created a bubble. In the sense, when I say a bubble, I mean this. Market, they have deliberately tried to create an environment of rising wealth, rising net worth. And they've done that by keeping interest rates extremely low or artificially low. And a bubble develops when markets move away, disconnect from reality. I will explain maybe later if there is an occasion, but very simply, we've had a very good increase in corporate profits. There's no denial about that. From 2009 to 2011, there's been a large increase in corporate profits, and I think that markets, at least stock markets, have reflected that and have reflected that properly. Ever since 2011, the rate of growth of corporate profits has slowed down very significantly. Over the past 12 months, revenues are actually lower than they were a year ago, industrial revenues, and profits are barely higher, and yet markets have gone higher. So this is what I would call an incipient bubble. And this bubble is not just in the U.S., but this bubble runs across almost all markets, and of course, as we will see, it runs across also real estate market. But it is a deliberate policy. This is not an accident, and this is something that, again, we have no experience of anything of this sort. We have never seen anything like this happen before. We have had bubbles in the past, but we have never had deliberate bubbles in the past. And how we re-enter sanity, how we re-enter the real world, is anyone's guess, but my feeling is that it will be very painful, re-entering into a more normal environment, because it will take a financial crisis and it will take a bust, a major crash. Let me now make two more points, one of them about me and the other one about the portfolio. Regarding myself, you know, I'm known to be very premature. You know, this is something that I've had going back all my professional life. This goes back 30 years or maybe 40 years, in which I've been always premature and have always taken positions, sometimes well ahead of events and sometimes not so far ahead of events. And of course, it's always been a very fortunate thing when it was not so far ahead of events. To be very, very ahead of events creates problems. It's almost as bad as being wrong in the market. So if I'm 2 years ahead of events, chances are that we're going to suffer, and chances are that we're going to lose money along the way, and it's going to be a much harder to make money afterwards. If I am not as far away from the events that I see happening, of course things may be better. And that was the case in some respect. That was the case in 2007, 2008, where we were not as far away from the actual event occurring. I'm afraid that this time we have been far away from the event occurring, and this is really the result has been, of course, what we've seen in the past, say, 4-6 quarters. Lastly, the last point I want to make regarding the portfolio. Coming in at the end of the first quarter, I explained in the letter that we made two major errors, trading errors, that were responsible for 100% basically of the losses. And that was a position that I took in gold, thinking that that would be a proper safe haven doing this thing that was happening. And again, I go back to the point that we have very little experience with debt-laden, with debt-heavy economies. We have very little experience. That's why you have people saying that when the Fed is doing what it's doing, we're going to have a runaway inflation, and then you have people saying that we're going to have deflation. We have very little experience. We cannot apply historical precedent. So my first thinking was gold should do well, especially well because it's a reserve asset, and especially well because we know that central banks are averse of taking risk, credit risk, so that they would want to lean towards buying more gold rather than buying more debt. And that did not work out well. And I had some warning along the way, and that it was acting, it was reacting well to some of the stimulus that we were seeing. I was reacting less well in financial assets. And by reacting less well in financial assets, that should have given me the cue that actually gold was still not ready to serve its role of safe haven. At any rate, I wrote about that, and we exited the position just from a discipline point of view. Finally, we exited the position regardless of what we thought the price would do. We wanted out just to look back, sit back, and see when do we go back in, and at what point we're going to do that, under what conditions. The other position that I discussed at the end of the quarter was that we had bought U.S. government bonds. We went to U.S. government bonds because U.S. government bonds are, again, in my view, were a safe haven in case of a problem. I was not concerned with inflation and the impact that it would have on notional bonds. In fact, when I added to the treasury market, I did not add via TIPS, but I added via notional bonds and nominal bonds. And that did not work out well. I did not take into account, that's the mistake, I did not take into account the impact that QE and the withdrawal of QE would have, at least what would happen to those bonds when they withdraw, or if they withdraw. We don't know that, but if and when they withdraw, what these bonds would do. Subsequent to that, I exited the U.S. Treasury market for the most part, retained the TIPS, a small amount of TIPS, and moved to German bonds. German bonds are not affected by quantitative easing. They are probably the most solvent, the Germans have heard it today, probably the most solvent of all countries if we were to measure by debt to income and by other measures such as deficit and so on. So the Germans, even though they're sitting in, they're in the midst of a sea of trouble, but the Germans are strong. And so in my mind, German bonds are the best credit instrument that we can have today, and one that should help us navigate through a difficult, troublesome period ahead. So that's the point that I wanted to make about premature, the error. I also wanted to say that and I'm known to be a contrarian, so it's not easy for me to be swayed from certain positions, even though newspaper headlines and television programs and so on tout or recommend certain investments, I tend to stick to my views, and most of the time those views are fairly, fairly contrarian to market sentiment. But that I think everybody is pretty much aware of and seen. But the last point I want to speak about is the portfolio. And since the quarter end, we all know, we have seen it, the portfolio has actually done something really unusual. It has come down almost every single day for the past, I think, 3 weeks. And that is an incredibly freakish phenomenon. And I'll explain why. The main culprits here have been the equity section of the fund. In the equity section of the fund, we have run a short to long ratio of about $2 for every dollar. We are short primarily emerging markets. We are long primarily U.S. housing, and in a ratio of about 2-1. Now, just simple mathematics, so if you can follow me, it's not a difficult exercise. We're short 170% of capital. We're long 85% of capital. So it's 2-1. under conditions where the market rallies 10%, if both markets, if both sides of the market were to rally at the same time, simultaneously, because the same factors make both markets go up or down, or more or less, then if that were to happen, we would probably lose about 8.5%. It turns out that our long position did not go up at all, and not only did not go up at all, but actually fell during the period and cost us 4% of equity. And so the rise in the emerging markets and the other markets that we were short was fully translated. So 170% translated into, and I'm getting now approximate numbers, but easy to follow, into a 17% decline, plus a 4% decline that arose out of the long position. And there you have a 21% decline in the portfolio. Some other things did a little bit better, so we probably trimmed that loss. But here is an extremely, extremely freakish occurrence, because even to go into more detail, we had 18 different short positions, 18 different short positions in that short equity basket, out of which 16 gave us losses and 2 were unchanged. Not a single one of them showed a gain during the period. For that to happen is pretty much a freak occurrence. And I almost called it to myself a perfect storm. And I don't like to use the term, because a perfect storm seems to be something that is not of your doing. It seems to be something that is that came from the outside. And I'm not trying to blame anybody. I'm not trying to blame the weather or anything like that. But the point is, the occurrence of such a phenomenon, to have your long position not react at all to the, let's say, the backpedaling that the Fed did, whereas the emerging markets did react with a vengeance, is in itself freakish. And the fact that every single one of the short positions created a loss is also very strange. But that explains, in short, the behavior of the portfolio. I want to go into details. As you ask me questions, I will get into some more details. All right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the candor and the roundedness of the explanation. Let me try and pull out of you how it is that the current portfolio, or the portfolio that existed, that caused all the losses, is an expression of the view that you talked about in your first point. You had bets in which you were long, short emerging markets, long bonds, primarily TIPS, and before you liquidated it, gold, each of them representing between 50 and 100% of the net asset value. How is it that that portfolio, that mix, represents a view that you said maybe early, but a view of a world imperiled by debt, an experimental world that imperiled by debt, the consequences of which are, in your words, catastrophic, and yet or the implication of your view of these being catastrophic and unknowably catastrophic. How does that portfolio reflect that?
Well, the let's say gold and treasuries and a short position in some equity markets that we felt are weak, are defensive positions. Those are positions that would do extremely well if we went into, let's say a depression. The gold, we're going to leave gold out for a moment because we're not exactly sure about that, because nobody is sure how gold will react in a depression. But at any rate, those two of the three positions for sure are positions that will do well in a catastrophic environment. The fourth position, which is housing, is really more like a hedge, and it's saying the following. It's saying that if the central banks are able to keep alive this cycle, to keep it alive by force feeding it, to keep it alive by keeping rates low and by making money and liquidity available in large quantities and easily available, then the first and biggest beneficiary would be the housing sector. The housing sector is typically, over the past 100 years, been an early mover in a business cycle, so that already in a recession, we see housing improve while other sectors of the economy are still contracting. So housing is an early leading indicator in some sort, and also one of the leading activities coming out of a depression. So again, we had a majority of positions betting on the quote-unquote catastrophe scenario, and we had a position that was, by the way, a very volatile position, and I counted on the fact that it was more volatile than the conventional stocks that we had in the short position. And this long position would probably not do very well in a depression, but it would do well, very well, during the time that the Fed was force-feeding the economy.
Okay, thank you. I think looking over the questions that have been emailed to me, to summarize, I think an underlying anxiety that people have, it would be to say that, or to recall the old adage that there is a difference between being right and doing right. And that, I think, is expressed in a question that was sent to us from an investor in Europe. And I'll read it. This man met you. He said that last time we met a year ago, you thought you'd make a lot of money when the system eventually faces reality. Now, you've said that your view may be premature. He goes on to say markets can keep going much longer than people betting against it can stay solvent. Does he, that's to say you, still have the humility to face reality and play opportunistically the game until it ends? In other words, while this view I don't think anybody will challenge your forecast. What people are concerned about is how you will play the game as with this forecast in your crosshairs.
Okay, that's a very good question. Of course, can you stay alive long enough to be able to get benefit of your view? And
exactly.
That is really, that's an age-old question in money management,
exactly.
Those of us who are macro traders, not system traders. And when we are macro traders and not system traders, we need to have what you call some points where we get off. Where do we get off?
Where do we get off?
Where do we get off? So the position that I've taken is, first of all, to acknowledge that that's a fact, acknowledge that that is true, that you can't forever fight City Hall, even if you know that City Hall is corrupt and will fall, but you can't forever. You have to take some protection. And what I've done, and maybe not enough of it, but I've definitely tried to do some of it. For example, I did liquidate the bond position, shifted it to German bonds, but liquidated the bond position and liquidated the gold position. Well, I'll come
You're
back
talking
to
about
gold
the tip, the tips primarily, right?
And I did liquidate a good substantial portion of the tips, and I'll come back to the tips later from a further look at it. And I liquidated the nominal bonds that we had in U.S. Treasuries. And in addition to that, what we have done is we have rigorously, on a daily basis, reviewed every single position that we are short with a view to determine whether that position, not the overall package, not the overall portfolio, but that position, does it have enough merit that we can stay in that with that position? In other words, I have applied something like a zero budgeting type of a philosophy. I said, if I start today and I'm giving today $10, do I put on that position? Is there enough reason for me to put on that position? And so we have applied, as I said, very rigorous test, and whatever and whenever we have seen that a certain position has, and I'm going to give an example now, has become more of a question mark than we when we first started, I have closed or liquidated or reduced the position. I'll just give one example, but there are many such examples. We had been short a stock in Australia, a producer of iron ore, Fortescue. Fortescue is very rich in iron ore, but has gotten into the disease of the time and has took on a tremendous amount of debt. Our feeling has been that Fortescue won't make it, won't actually make it, especially because we feel the iron ore, being so dependent on China, eventually will go lower. Well, here's the thing that happened. Along the way, and we had a strong position short Fortescue. Along the way, the Australian dollar came off from 105 to 90 cents, or 91 cents. There was a drop of about 15% in the value of Australian dollar. That's a new factor, because that can allow a producer in Australia, an inefficient producer in Australia, selling an international commodity to survive simply because their costs have gone down 15%. And, of course, their revenues in local currency have gone up 15%. So that was – meaning we are facing a dynamic world. It's not something static. Fortescue may not be a company that will survive, and I think eventually it won't survive. But for now, it was not justified that we should have a 15% or 14% exposure. We would want to reduce that to maybe an 8% exposure. And if we see that a company makes or takes advantage or has taken advantage of the better currency environment, we will cut back further that position. So to summarize, the only thing we can do is, rather than taking a wholesale approach to this, is to say, let me look at every single position every single day. Can I justify being in that position or not? And to the extent that I can justify, I stay. Sometimes I replace it with something that may be better, because I do want to keep that short position for when the time comes. But if I can't find anything better, then out it goes, and maybe we reduce some of the long side.
Okay, let's talk about housing, which is a large position.
Yeah,
you were very early to home builders. I think you first put on the position in 2009, did very, very well for you. You've been a believer in home builders since then. In the last since the Fed started tapering talk, the long end of the market rose, and there was a great deal of anxiety. Some home builder surveys show that it's been overdone. Yet at the same time, there are some companies who've really been punished. Horton and Pulse have been really smashed. Where do you stand now with home builders? What's your view of home builders now?
Okay, yes.
How big is the position starting off?
Let's start with the position. The position is equal to about 55% of the capital of the fund, 55%, and represents the majority of our long position in equities. Now, where do we stand? Where we stand is that we still think, and it's more than we still think, we think that it's better. It's a better position today than it was 4 weeks ago, and it's a better long position than it was 8 weeks ago. We think that it is an extraordinarily good long position. And the reason is that the fundamentals, the main fundamentals, are very strong behind them. They have a very, leaving aside minor fluctuations in rates and things of that sort, the fundamentals for housing are extremely strong. And here's the scoop in a few short sentences. There was very little construction for quite a number of years, and there's a natural increase in population. So there's a demand for housing that increases and is pent up. At the same time, house prices have begun a cycle of what we might call now an investment cycle. And that is, three years ago, house prices were going up 3-4% a year. 2 years ago, they were going up 5-6% a year. In the past year, we've seen prices accelerate on the upside, and now we see numbers that are sort of like 2-3% a month. So we have developed, we are in an incipient bubble. Housing is in an incipient bubble. But a bubble only because there's a tremendous lack of supply. The market is now consolidated into the hands of a few large manufacturers and players that have some land to build. And so the profit margins are very good. And what's happening is that there's going to be a few years in which they can continue to build and make very good profits. What happened is that the market being so short-term minded, and this is a problem with the market today, everybody is into short, going in today, going out tomorrow, and just trying to see where they can take advantage on a very short-term basis. But the rise in rates was something that immediately was translated into, there's got to be a huge impact on housing, and prices were marked down 10% in a week practically. I mean, it was incredible. That some of the leading housing stocks are down 22% in the past 3 weeks.
Yeah, Horton in particular.
Some of them are stocks that we own. So that doesn't make sense. Well, we have seen, some of these companies have said, that traffic has slowed down a little bit. We have seen that cancellation rates have gone up a little bit. They've gone from 20 to 25%, which is not an enormous amount. But on the whole, we think all of this is a sticker shock. That's the problem. It's not the level of rates. If you think about it logically, the real rate of interest that applies to housing is negative. And this is not something our own logic. This is a logic that good economists have already expressed. If the asset is going up 2-3% a month, and your cost of money has gone up from 3.5% a year to 4.5% a year, the cost of money is hugely negative. And anybody who is rational, when he sees prices going up in 1 month as much as what he has to pay practically for a whole year, will not take into account the cost of money. So our feeling is it's a Wall Street engineered reaction. It is a few people who are nervous about rising rates and think that these rising rates will now move, we're going to move from 4.5% to 6% or 7% in the next 6 months or a year, and this will affect housing prices. We don't think so. We think that even without making a call on interest rates, and I don't want to make a call now on interest rates, without making a call on interest rates, this market can easily absorb a move to 5% because we are in the midst of a bubble, and this thing is going to continue until the time that the Fed takes the foot off the accelerator.
I think it was yesterday, that the long-term trend in the affordability index allows for mortgage rates to rise to as high as 6% and prices of homes to rise by 18% before they're fairly priced. Let's move on to gold and to commodities in general. You no longer have gold, and yet, as you said at the outset, gold or in explaining the view that you had at the outset, you said that gold was one of the pillars of that, or not one of the pillars, at least part of the construction of that kind of view. Where do you stand with gold now? And while you're at it, perhaps you might talk also about oil, which have been had a relationship.
Okay, our feeling stores gold remain very, very warm. You know, we Yeah, first of all, I just want to make a note that the asset allocation fund, which is a long-term fund and it's not leveraged, and it makes very few changes during the year, I have maintained a long position in gold there. I can't recall exactly the percentage now, but I believe that we are long about 10 or 12% of the fund is in gold. So our position in gold is we like it. We need to time it better. And the only way I can think of timing it better is to say, when will gold be priced by the market better, or when will it become more desirable than a financial asset? It is a fact that for the past few years, people have preferred financial assets because financial assets pay dividends or pay interest. And so if I had to choose, or if somebody had to choose between owning gold that doesn't earn any income or pays no dividends, or owning a financial asset, he'd probably choose a financial asset. We've seen this. And the way we've seen it is by looking at the ratio. A ratio that had gone in favor of gold for over 10 years, from 1999 to 2011, also 2010, turned negative as soon as rates hit the floor and as soon as people began to feel that they're better off owning an income-generating asset. And that, to me, is really the key to timing gold. I want to see that despite this, despite the fact that there is a preference for income, that despite its preference for income, gold begins to do better than financial assets. We're getting close. We're probably getting closer, definitely closer than we were 3 months ago. We're getting closer. I say that we're getting closer because I look at graphs and I look at charts and I look at the relationship between the two and I look at the action on a daily basis, and I'm beginning to see that that gold is starting to push back, let's call it, its status of being in disfavor. I'm not sure we're there yet. But also importantly, I should mention that gold has moved on and off backwardation in the front months, meaning that there is something strange going on in the bullion market. There is a tightness of near-term supplies. People are paying a small premium for near-term supplies, something that hasn't happened in a long, long time, and when it does happen, it's very rare. And there's been a very large withdrawal of gold from visible warehouses like COMEX. So we're not sure what is happening. We think that there may be some very substantial buyers that are not showing their hands, they're not exposing their hands. They want secrecy, but maybe at the same time, maybe the market has maybe central banks have oversold gold because they have leased it and lent it out, and now there's a call on them to repay it. We've seen something very strange. I've heard stories. I have not been able to confirm it. For example, that Germany asked for gold asked for its gold back from Fort Knox, 300 tons. Now that is a fact. But what I have not been able to confirm is what happened after that. Apparently, the U.S. has made a deal with Germany that it will return the gold over 7 years. That is very unusual and very strange that it would take 7 years to pay back that gold, especially when some of the gold will stay in New York in some warehouses. Again, these are anecdotes that have not been confirmed, but there is something going on in the gold market that leads me to believe that at some point gold will be an extremely attractive asset, and we want to own that asset. We're watching it very closely.
We are not, although it's not a major position, it's not an insignificant position. I'm talking about oil. There's a lot of talk of increased supply of oil because of fracking in North America. The United States is becoming a net exporter of energy for the first time in many decades. But at the same time, less noted is potentially reduced supply from OPEC. You're short the back months. Where do you stand with oil?
Okay, we've had a short position in oil now for a number of years, and we continue to have it. I've always mentioned that the one single risk we see in the oil market is the possibility of some occurrence in the Middle East, such as war with Iran, that would affect oil supplies going through the Straits of Hormuz or anything of that sort, or maybe the bombing of oil fields in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. So there's always a latent risk in that oil market, and as a result, it is difficult to get short without worrying about what would happen if there is such an accident and what happens to your position. What we have chosen to do, and this is a position that we have held now for a number of years, we have chosen to go short in the U.S., the U.S. market, rather than the international market based in London, the Brent. We've gone short what's called WTI, West Texas Intermediate. First of all, because being a domestic oil, it's less likely to be affected by international restrictions. And secondly, because the U.S. has become a substantial producer of oil, and therefore it's likely to keep prices a little bit lower than world prices. And we have gone short, not the near month, but the back month, and the thinking being that if anything were to happen in the Middle East, it would affect the near positions. It would affect the one-month, three-month, six-month position, but it's not likely to affect the four-year position or the three-year position. And so our position has been short those back months, and we've been long one-third, the ratio has been 1-3, we've been long one-third via Brent, the international market in oil. Again, that is as a hedge. If something were to happen, then we'd probably capture immediately that gain. Interestingly enough, of course, when we took that position, we realized that we were also making a bet on the what's called the WTI Brent spread. Brent had traded up to $20 higher than WTI, and we were buying Brent and selling WTI, and so actually we were buying a spread that was historically at a high. Nevertheless, we still did it and did not suffer. I would think that we are probably, I mean, for this year, we're probably up a little bit in our position. Last year, the first part of last year, we lost a little bit of money. The second half, we made some money. So I would say that we're treading water, maybe slightly plus on that position. And we still see the day will come when, maybe after a resolution of the Middle East situation, but the day will come when we will see oil trade in the 30s and 40s. And I think everybody heard about this tweet that the Saudi Alawi just sent around, or at least he sent this note to the Minister of Energy in Saudi Arabia, telling him that demand, oil demand in the West is declining rapidly, and they should diversify away from oil because it's a commodity that is going to come into surplus. We strongly believe that will be the case. Between natural gas, fracking natural gas, and fracking in oil, and other savings that will develop, we believe that oil is on its way down.
We talk about oil and we talk about gold. It leads us directly to the Canadian dollar. A lot of our clients are Canadian. A lot of people are interested in the Canadian dollar. We had a bearish view that was based to a certain extent on a bearish view of commodities and to a certain extent on the view that housing prices were overblown and that a credit crisis of some magnitude may have occurred. The housing crisis seems to have blown over. The commodity issue was not. Where do you stand with the Canadian dollar?
I don't stand. I don't really have a view. Canada has a much better fiscal position than the U.S., and at least the federal government does, not the provinces. We do see trouble in some of the provinces like Ontario and Alberta, but Canada is thought to be an energy producer, and therefore it's thought that its currency have some, bear some relation to the term straight, and it probably does. It probably does. So to the extent that commodity prices go down and to the extent that oil goes down, I would think that there would be downward pressure on the Canadian dollar. But I don't have a view. I don't have a strong view in there.
Okay. Let's come back to the beginning and talk for a minute. So to your very first comment, where you say that you have an issue of prematurity, not immaturity, but prematurity. Take the opportunity to say that when clients ask me what's happening with Friedberg, is there anything personal that's going on with him? I tell them that I've known you for 40 years, and I've never seen you for a second lose the pleasure you take in markets, the focus that you have in markets, and the kind of obsessiveness that you have in thinking about markets. And part of that is a kind of youthfulness that sort of, in a way, is immature. There is something that's really boyish about the way you've always thought about markets. If you feel that you've been premature, forget about immature, but premature, then what is it that you're going to do? You've acknowledged that you have a premature, that you've tended to be premature. You've acknowledged that it's your Achilles heel. You're calling, you think that in the future something disastrous is going to occur. You acknowledge that there's this constant issue that we have in managing money, of being able to keep our chips in front of us for when we get the tickets. What are you going to do now?
Okay, I just hope you don't think that having a passion is boyish. But
well, in a way, it is.
All right. What am I going to do? So here, I want to discuss another point, and I've been asked this before by a number of clients. Actually, the question was, people who don't have that much experience in the market, but at least it was a valid question. Why don't you wait until you see the whites of their eyes and then act, right? That's the question. In other words, why take the risk of being premature? Wait until it happens.
Exactly.
And then, so, you know, here's the problem. Here's the problem. There's two problems with that. Number one, wait until it happens. So let's take the example of what happened 4 weeks ago. 4 weeks ago, it looked like the Fed was going to take the foot off the accelerator. They talked about tapering. Well, the market was trying to make it think that it was tapering, or the market then thought, well, that's how they all start. They all started with a little move, a small step. You know, a small step for me is a big step for mankind. But I forget already the saying. But the market thought the Fed started its cycle, the tightening cycle. And so markets came down very quickly and very violently, and we had a 5% drop in a few days, in a couple of days, maybe 3 days. And the question was, well, I don't have a position. Do I believe that now it's coming, that this Armageddon is coming? Do I think that it's about to happen? And if I do jump at that moment into the market and I say, okay, I'm going to get short now heavily, I run the risk that I called it incorrectly and I get whipsawed. And whipsawing is a more damaging even than being premature. I think that's what I think. To be whipsawed 2, 3, or 4 times is not only costly in your pocket, but it's psychologically damaging. A manager has to find himself comfortable all the time. That's why I tell you always, get me a cup of coffee now, get me a cup of tea, I gotta sit in a good chair. I gotta be comfortable. If I'm not comfortable, if I got whipsawed 3 times, I'm beginning to think that I'm an idiot, and I'm not capable of finding this thing, and I'm gonna give up. So it's not good enough to wait until it happens, because we don't know when it happens. But here's a second and more difficult problem. When you're in a bubble, the end of a bubble is actually one single day. I repeat, bubbles end in one single day. And just go back for a moment. You and I were at that time trading gold in 1979, and October 1979 gold was $350. And from October to January, gold went from $350 to $850. And January the 4th, 1980, gold hit a high and closed that day down on the day after being up like $50 an ounce. It was one day, and that was the end of the story. And there was no news at the time, and the market just turned down. I'm not sure that this thing will, the same thing will happen this time with no news. I don't know it will happen with no news. I believe that it probably will be accompanied with a piece of news. Like, for example, on a weekend, some European country deciding that they will not honor debt anymore, they have to sit down with creditors and do something else, or else there'll be not a single person employed in the country. If that happens on a weekend, markets are likely to open substantially lower. Markets may crash on Monday morning. It's very late to put on a position at that point. You're joining everybody else, and you're already behind the eight ball by a very substantial amount. And you never know. The Fed may come Monday morning and say, well, you know, we are going to be extending a $650 billion loan to Portugal so that they can survive for now. Again, it is impossible to operate after the fact. That's what I believe, especially when you are in the midst of a bubble. What you have to do, and this is the question, what do you do? What do you do when you're premature? What you have to do is you have to try to find those positions that if nothing happens, if the world continues to waddle along, you can still make enough money to cover some or all of the other bets. We have not been able to do that well yet. Yet. I believe that we will. I believe that we will. I believe that we're getting closer. I believe that now is the moment that we are getting a lot, that we have tweaked it enough that we think that now we should be able to at least survive that prematureness or prematurity. Well, I'm not sure what you say.
I'm not sure myself. You sent a memo around to the salespeople at Freeburg Mercantile Group Limited, saying that in the wake of if there were redemptions from the Global Macro Trust, that you would buy all the units. Is that an expression of comfort? You say that you need to be comfortable. Are you comfortable then?
I'm extremely comfortable, and I do think that taking a position today is again, having bought units of the fund 3 weeks or 4 weeks ago, I would have felt the same. But today I feel even more confident that we have done enough and that we are on the way to understanding the problem even in a more fine way, in a finer way, so that I'm very confident that we should do well in the next few months.
Okay, Al, thank you. Thank you for your candor. And on behalf of all of us who are investors, we wish you well and hope that you recover from this terrible episode that we're all undergoing. Thank you very much for your time. Just take the opportunity to tell listeners that for those of you who want to listen to the call in retrospect, we'll be sending a link to an MP3 file. The MP3 file is also available on both the Freeburg Mercantile Group and the Niagara Capital websites. Thanks again, Albert. Good luck.
And I want to thank everybody who is on the call and those who have not made it to the call for the confidence that they've given us. I see a lot of questions, and I see a lot of doubts and a lot of fears maybe, and anxiety definitely, but I see a lot of confidence. Very, very few people have decided to redeem, and I appreciate that. I really appreciate that. It's very comforting for the manager who already has a stake and who's not just a manager to know that there's confidence in it.
Thanks, Albert. Bye-bye.